Hi, thanks for listening. This is the It's a Widget Flutter podcast. My name is Hilla Carney. Each episode, we get a chance to speak to another amazing member of the Flutter community. This episode, we are extremely lucky to be speaking with David. Welcome.
Hi, Dad.
Hi, thanks for being on the podcast. So to start, can you share a bit about your background?
Yeah, of course. So I'm originally from England, from a small town near Manchester, Redbull. I'm looking for the right word. I don't know if it's hobbyist or an enthusiast, coder, programmer. I've really been into computers pretty much my whole life. So I started programming in BASIC when I was, 5 years old or thereabouts. It's really been a big part of everything I've done. And I always wanted to be actually a games programmer. That was my kind of dream. And I grew up spending a lot of time thinking about, hey, how is this computer game implemented? How is this, how are the enemies deciding what to do and this kind of thing? So that was a really big part of my childhood. And then when I applied to uni, obviously I picked computer science, and my kind of love for the area just grew. I learned about Linux and got into open source, and kind of graduated with a real yearning to get something done, to build something. So rather than stay in academia, I didn't do a PhD or anything like that. Rather than stay in academia, I went straight for a job writing software. So I went to London, as many English people do, and worked for a small company that was doing financial data processing. And I have to say, working for a small company was really fun. If you have a chance to do it as a developer, I highly recommend it. You just have so much freedom working for a small company. And I worked on the internal tools that we were using to process data. And what I learned doing that was that I really love making tools. And in particular, I really love making tools for people who are kind of a bit like me. During their day, they're doing technical tasks, they're using tools. I love making those tools. And from where I could sit in that job, I could actually sort of see the people who were benefiting from my work. And I really liked that. So kind of during that, I dropped my idea that I would work on games and decided actually building software, building tools. That's really what I'm into. And one kind of example that I like to give, I discovered that there was a guy in the office who every Friday would have to check all of the data files that had been produced and check that had been sent out correctly. And that was kind of his Friday evening. He had to stay a bit late to do that. And I just thought, I can script that in probably a couple of hours. And his Friday is always going to be better as a result. And that just made me really happy. So after a couple of years in that job, I was looking for something new, and applied to Google more or less on a whim. And to my great surprise, I got in. And to my even greater surprise, they offered me a job in Switzerland. So in 2008, I moved from London to Zurich to work for Google. And that's kind of the end of my background story. I've been a Google software engineer since 2008.
Nice. It's amazing. And I guess 2008 is before Dart even existed. So what were you doing initially at Google, then how did you end up on the Dart team?
Yeah, that's a great question. This is going to be quite a long answer. I need to warn you. Let's see. So in 2010, I was working on AdWords. AdWords is the part of Google where you can buy many of Google's ads products. And the part of AdWords that I was on was AdWords for video, which is the part that sells the skippable ads on YouTube. And actually, I was part of the team that first made and launched that thing. We built some of the first YouTube advertising kind of capabilities and systems. And kind of a side note, but that was a really fun place to be. I really enjoy now that I can say I was on YouTube in the fairly early days of YouTube. AdWords itself is really interesting. I think a lot of people, I mean, small businesses that have probably seen AdWords, but a lot of people haven't seen it. And that's interesting to me because it's quite an important part of how the internet works. It powers Google. And it's open to the public. You can just go to adwords.google.com and poke around. You can see what people are actually doing when they buy the ads that you see probably every day on Google search or browsing around the internet or on YouTube. So I do recommend taking a look. And it's also interesting because it's a really, really big, complicated web app. And maybe people wouldn't get too excited about that today, but in 2010, it was probably one of the biggest, most complex web apps there was. Like it was a pretty amazing piece of work. And it was written in Java, and it was compiled to JavaScript with something called the Google Web Toolkit, abbreviated to GWT or GWT, which I don't know how well known that is now, but that's what we were working with. And back then in 2010, the web was pretty different how it is now. This was before browser standardization had really taken off. So making such a complex web app work was really hard. And GWT did a lot of the heavy lifting for us. It made a lot of things just work. But it wasn't perfect. One particular issue was that this was back in the days of Java 6. And if you wanted to write a callback in Java 6, you had to write an anonymous in a class. It was horribly verbose. And this was also before, at this time, web code was very heavy on callbacks. This was before futures and promises and that kind of thing became popular. So this embrace of the finders meant I was really looking out for something new. And that is when Dart arrived on the scene. So I became aware of the existence of Dart. Saw some early demos. And just instantly thought that is exactly addressing the problems that I have in my day-to-day work. And actually, I think I was probably one of the first real fans of Dart. I spent a lot of time annoying my colleagues, explaining how great Dart was and how it would solve all our problems. I remember being particularly impressed by the future and iterable APIs. They just beautifully solved everything that I was struggling with every day. And also by the language itself, it was really compact. It was easy to understand. So this continued for a while with me experimenting with Dart code, annoying all my colleagues about it, until I put together a demo of something that we could do, like an example, something like we were building in Java and GWT. Here it is in Dart, and here's what the dev cycle will look like. Dart is always focused on a fast dev cycle, fast iterate and recompile. And my team was sufficiently impressed that we decided, okay, let's start writing code in Dart. We'll continue with Java GWT, but we'll start building pieces in Dart. And this was, in fact, before Dart 1. So I'd been writing Dart professionally since before Dart had async and await. That's how far back it was, if you can believe. So we started building in Dart. It was tremendously fun. We were working closely with the Dart team at the time just to make things work, to make this thing that we were trying to build and launch work in Dart. Now, the rest of AdWords, because our bit, AdWords video, is just a small piece, the rest of AdWords also noticed Dart and that it was a good fit for what AdWords was doing. And they also decided to rewrite in Dart, but that kind of, if you compare our little kind of tiny piece of AdWords rewrite to the whole AdWords rewrite, it's a completely different story. So the AdWords rewrite was a tremendously big project. And by the way, I will a bit refer to things that are Google internal, so I have to be a bit careful. But the reason I can tell you this story is because there are one or two articles published on the AdWords rewrite and why it was in Dart. Okay. So the AdWords rewrite in Dart was a fantastic project to be on. It's amazing that it worked. The project is so big; it is one of the main revenue sources that Google has. And we just rewrote the whole thing in Dart. It was a fantastic project to build. And during that work, my interest in tooling and infrastructure kind of showed. I got interested in supporting the fast Dart dev cycles through the work we were doing. I wrote built Pyu and built collection kind of infra libraries and packages to help us with what we needed to do. And that meant that I started working with all the teams at Google that were doing Dart. So just kind of my role grew from just working on AdWords for video to Dart generally. And in 2016, there's a talk that I gave at a developer conference, which was essentially about built Pyu. It was called the YouTube skip button and object models with package source gen, which is kind of a lot of words in a name, but it's still on YouTube if you go look for it. And coincidentally, it was pretty much around then that I had the opportunity to actually switch teams and work on the Dart team. So I jumped at the chance and switched to Dart. However, that's not the end of the story. That's the middle of the story, because the piece of the Dart team that I switched to was the piece that is that was supporting the Google internal teams doing Dart. So I was on Dart, but not in any way that is visible from outside Google, apart from little things. So I released built Pyu built collection. At some point, I released a package called Pedantic, which was the set of lints that we were using at Google. And the reason that was something I did was because I was, as part of being on tools and build in Google, I was doing work to improve the code base as a whole. So we weren't actually just picking the lints that were applied. We were also cleaning up the whole code base to comply with the lints that we thought were a good way to write Dart. Let's see. So I stayed in that role for about 5 years until 2021. At which point I took a brief detour to work on GPay. I worked with the GPay India team on the India app. And I have to say India because GPay in India is a different app, a different experience to where it is in other parts of the world. So if you haven't used GPay India, then you haven't used the thing that I worked. But I ended up actually working on mostly on Flutter end-to-end testing, which is a really interesting area. But I think we should probably skip over that since I have thought it was all Google internal, so nothing actually useful for anyone who's listening to this. And then I decided, okay, I missed actually being on the Dart team, on close to the Dart team, so circle back to join the Dart team with the goal of working on something open source. And that was in 2022. But still the story doesn't quite end there because although my intention was to work on open source Dart, there was this thing that really needed doing for Dart at Google. And that was this little thing called null safety, or if you like Dart 3. We had a lot of Dart code that needed to move to Dart 3. And making that happen was a really good fit with work that I'd done up to that point in kind of general code base health and build tooling. So I took another short diversion to do that. And a couple of years later, I just joined the Dart team proper at the start of 2024 and picked up my first feature, which is one that you've certainly heard of. And that was macros. So that's how I ended up on the Dart team.
That's a great story. Thank you for sharing all those details. Really fascinating, especially kind of the inner workings of how things progress within Google. So let's just bring up macros. So it seems like macros didn't work out as I think as the community had hoped. You know, where does it stand currently?
I mean, macros as a feature or the kind of the general area?
It seemed like as a feature, there was hope that it would be the one change that would solve everything. But I think it was a few months ago, it was doing it in a way which was both good developer experience as well as good performance seemed challenging.
So it seems like they've scaled back the goals.
Yes. So macros, the feature as such was cancelled. They announced that in January, I think it was. And really the kind of headline reason is that we just couldn't get to a point where we were convinced that we could finish it. Like the finish line was not getting closer, and we decided to cut our losses and say, okay, we need to refocus on things that actually are going to happen. Two of those pieces that still are planned are two of the language features which originally were part of macros. So one of those is augmentations, and the other is enhanced parts. I can talk about those a little bit if it's interesting.
That'd be wonderful. Can you speak about both of them? I'm very curious.
Yeah, so enhanced parts is, as the name suggests, it means you can do more with parts. It allows them to be nested, so you can have a part which itself has parts, which itself has parts. And it allows them to have imports. So you can have a part which contributes imports to the library. And both of those are kind of pretty closely targeted at what CodeGen wants to do. Because today, a generator has to decide whether it will generate a library, in which case it can have imports, or whether it will generate a part, in which case it can't, but it has the advantage of being able to see private symbols in the library. So with enhanced parts, you won't have to make that trade-off. You can just use enhanced parts for everything, essentially, and have the full power of being able to add imports. So that's quite exciting to look forward to. And then augmentations. Augmentations is about smoothing how CodeGen currently works. In most CodeGen setups, you end up referring to generated symbols in the code that you write. There's a convention that you use a dollar or underscore dollar, and it's just it's very basic. It's not particularly pleasant to use. It's not particularly pleasant to read. So augmentations allows you to, for example, write the API of a method in one place, and then somewhere else, later in the file or in a part file, you can write the implementation. And again, that's really perfect for what CodeGen wants to do.
Cool. And so speaking of CodeGen, I know there are a whole bunch of separate packages that all kind of work together. For example, there's Build Runner, which I think is the foundation, and then on top of that is Build Value, Build to Collection, etc. Just kind of explaining how it all fits together and how they compare to the packages like JSON Serializable, for example.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the short answer about those packages, and including SourceGen, that whole family, is that they really were motivated by things that people really wanted to do, or things that people really needed to do, rather than a kind of overarching strategy. So for example, I created and open sourced Build Collection and Build Value because that was what we wanted for the work we were doing on AdWords for Video at the time. It was purely, we want to build data models in this way. There isn't a way to do it. So very early in Dart's lifecycle. So if you wanted something, you had to build it. So yeah, we built it and open sourced it. SourceGen and JSON Serializable are both from Kevin Moore, who was and is a Dart PM. He was super enthusiastic about CodeGen and wanted to make it a really nice experience. He was excited about what the analyzer gives to the Dart ecosystem. It's a really powerful tool just to kind of hand over to your developers and say, you have full access to everything in the language all the time. And JSON Serializable was obviously something that people needed to do serialization. So he thought that was something that he wanted to do at the time. And then the build system itself, Build Runner, was a rewrite. So before Build Runner, Pub had a thing called Transformers. That was how Dart did CodeGen. And Transformers could take your source code and turn it into actually any other source code. So in a sense, they were more powerful than Build Runner is. But that also came with huge problems. Just allowing arbitrary modification of source means that later on, when you're trying to figure out why your code is doing what it's doing, you have a hard time figuring out what's going on. So BuildRunner was a rewrite of that to be easier to understand, easier to follow, and to fit in better with build systems like Bazel that we use internally at Google, that actually might not expect files to be overridden during the build. So this kind of ecosystem, and I guess Mockito also falls into that. It was something that we needed, that people needed, that was going to be part of the platform and was created at the time. So this was all about 9 or 10 years ago that this got set up. So a lot has really changed since then. And one thing that I'm trying to do at the moment is to figure out what is the coherent story that we're telling around these packages. From the point of view of users, what should users be doing, or do we have a recommendation? What should builder maintainers be doing, or do we have a recommendation? SourceGen and package build and even the analyzer itself, what are the important things that we support? What can we improve? Where can we move the whole story? And I think that is, it's always been important, but with the arrival of new language features, enhanced parts and augmentations, it's going to be really important that we have a good story for just best practice, or even just showing how to use these in a good way, or figuring out what the good way is. And that's something that I want to personally get behind. Let's see. Built value and JSON serializable. I mean, there's always competition between packages. We have Phrase, built value, JSON serializable, kind of nudging at each other in a similar space. For me, that's reasonably straightforward. Built value was created for a particular purpose, which it fills quite well. JSON serializable does something a bit different. Phrase does something a bit different. So they kind of, for me, they coexist reasonably comfortably.
We started with JSON serializable, not realizing we were working with Redux, which I guess isn't so popular anymore, but we had a challenge with immutability. So we switched from JSON serializable to built value to get immutability for free, basically, as part of the code gen. Are there other benefits you think that JSON serializable has that you would use it recommended over built value?
I'm not actually super familiar with JSON serializable. I think so built value, as you know, when you use built value, you have to use the whole thing. So you use it for defining your classes as well as for serializing them. JSON serializable is more lightweight, and so that's can very often be what you want. The kind of strongly defining feature of built value, funnily enough, is one that I think people don't very often use it for. So the idea of built value is that you should be able to create your object model essentially as you like, then serialize it and deserialize shortly afterwards. It's actually designed for client-to-server communication. And the reason that's important is because the way it's kind of envisaged to be used is that you immediately deserialize again, and then you do something else to put it in your database or backend or whatever. And the reason that's important is because it means it's because you're not keeping the data around for a long time, you have the freedom to do quite to build quite complex structures. You can, for example, built value supports, you can have an interface and different classes that implement it. And as long as they are all implemented with built value, you can then serialize a list of that interface, and it will take care of the types for you. And that's a pretty neat thing to do for temporary serialization, but it doesn't work particularly well if you're going to stick that in a database, because then you have to worry about all the different subtypes in your database, and it's quite painful. So built value is about temporary serialization of object models, and it's not about mapping to JSON APIs, which I think is what most people are using these packages for most of the time. So there's kind of a bit of a mismatch, but you can use it for that too. And when people use it, that's usually what they use it for.
Yes, that applies to us. So I've noticed on Twitter recently you're making a lot of improvements. Can you discuss that, or where your focus has been and what changes you're making?
Yeah, so I have been a user of BuildRunner for a very long time. Obviously, I wrote BuildValue 9-10 years ago now. But it's only this year that I started getting into the code base. And where that came from, actually, it came directly out of the macro cancellation. So having canceled macros, we were looking, well, what do we do in this space? And I felt pretty strongly that there were improvements that were possible to what people were doing today. So to the current BuildRunner and the current generators, and we could make that a good chunk better. And so even leaving open the possibility of future language features related to something like macros or code gen or in that area, it would make sense to push what we currently offer as far as possible first. So that was kind of the idea that I came on with. BuildRunner is an extremely complicated tool. It has taken me quite a few months head down to really get into it and start making improvements. And actually, the first thing that I focused on was scalability. Is it the case that if you give BuildRunner 1,000 files, 10,000 files, 50,000 files, is it still going to be sensibly fast? And when I first looked at it, the answer was no. Actually, if you start getting it, those crazy numbers of files, there were things inside BuildRunner that would just not scale, it would just get slow. And so the first thing that I wanted was that we had a basis for the tool such that we can say, actually, this is going to scale to whatever size code base you have. And so the kind of first big refactoring that I did was to work through everything and make it possible that it scales well. That kind of performance-focused work is still ongoing, like the kind of core change, the core refactoring that I want is done. And now there are a bunch of hopefully smaller, easier improvements on top of that are kind of lined up. So that was the 2.5 release. And also for that release, I totally rewrote the logging. I wanted that what BuildRunner outputs while it's running is just super, super clear about what is happening, why it's happening, where the time is going. And so I really kind of put my head down, focused on that, and produced something that I think people are reasonably happy with. At least there's been some positive feedback. And then I switched tracks a bit. I had to work on still on BuildRunner, but on the analyzer, we refer to it as the Element 2 migration. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the term, but the analyzer is going through a breaking API change, essentially to support augmentations, the language feature. So the API change introduces the concept of fragments, which is that when you write a method, as I described, if you use augmentations, you can write the API of method and the implementation of the method in different places. So the analyzer now introduces this concept called fragments, which represents those different places when it needs to. Unfortunately, that's breaking change for everyone. So the job that I did next was to release BuildRunner with those changes, and also to help some builder owners over that hurdle to get their builders released. And since then, I'm back on to BuildRunner and just kind of tackling the improvements that I want to make from every possible angle, usability, performance, have a really long list of things that I want to do. For example, the 2.7 release has a new feature on performance that I think people are probably not aware of yet. It allows builders to restrict when they run. It's called triggers. So a builder can say, this builder is triggered by import build value. And it will only run if you import build value in that library. And so if you don't, it's essentially free. It's much cheaper than it would be today. And it has a similar thing you can say with annotations. You can say this builder only runs if this particular annotation is used. And again, if it means that if it doesn't trigger, it's cheaper. So I'm hoping this leads to noticeable performance improvements. In theory, you can try this yourself. You can write in the build.yaml file that you have all of the things you would need to turn on this feature. But what I want to happen is that builder maintainers find that this works well enough to add it to their builders. And so this is something that will just be for free and everyone gets better performance for free. And the next thing I'm doing on performance is I'm removing mirrors from SourceGen, use of Dart mirrors, which means that it can be compiled AOT compilation, ahead of time compilation, which just generally gives a performance boost. So we'll be able to compile the builders in a different way so that they're faster. And so on and so on. There really is a long list of things. Another thing that I'm excited about is looking at caching analysis results. So Build Runner should be able to, if it analyzes files, it should be able to save that and reuse it when you run it again. And also sharing analysis results with the IDE. It should be the case that if your IDE analyzes a file, Build Runner doesn't have to reanalyze it. Or maybe also the other way around, if Build Runner analyzed it, your IDE doesn't have to do it. And that would be a big speed up across the board. Longer term, this is just such a huge list of things to do. Longer term, the questions, there are interesting questions around IDE integration. That's one thing that people are always asking for, and it's totally understandable why you want Build Runner to fit nicely into your workflows. Today, that means almost always an IDE. And so that has to work well. Build Runner should work well in workspaces. Workspaces are a feature where you can have multiple packages with one, essentially one shared pub spec, which is great for analyzing performance. It's a great way to develop multiple packages together. But today you have to run Build Runner separately in each of those packages, which can obviously be much better. And then I already talked a bit about the new language features, and Build Runner is going to need to support those well. And also we need to have good examples of what builders should be doing. And we need to update all of the builders that we own to use those well. So I think I've got enough work for quite a while on the build packages.
It's a nice list. I have to say, as an end user of Build Value, I very much appreciate the improvements. I'm still running a slightly older version of Flutter. But one of the main reasons I'm excited to upgrade is to be able to get these performance improvements. It's just that big difference, right? If it takes from, you know, a minute to 6 seconds, that difference of switching out to start a YouTube video, just distract myself rather than just keep coding, that has a big impact on just overall performance as a developer. So it's great.
Yes, totally. And in fact, back when I worked on Google internal stuff, I was obsessed with just those metrics. How many seconds are all our engineers having to wait for a rebuild or for, you know, the equivalent of a hot reload or whatever? Because the way we had this set up, those hot reload cycles also had to do some incremental build almost always. And so the kind of build steps, Build Runner like build steps, were really on the critical path for development. And so we've really tried to make them fast.
Right. Although it's funny, I mean, it's like many developers these days, rather waiting for my code to build, I'm waiting for my AI to finish running and generating my code.
Yes.
A different new set of problems, get my AI to run faster. So is there any advice you'd give someone just starting out, new to Dart and or Flutter?
Yeah, I'm full of good advice. So let me see. So if someone's just getting into coding, I think coding is such a huge area. There's so much to learn. There's so much to do. And I think one of the traps is that actually you can spend time kind of working on understanding using complexity that actually is not really buying you anything in return. So my advice for kind of just building any code base, Dart and Flutter code bases included, is to figure out how to make it simple. Figure out what are the simplest building blocks that do enough for what you're trying to do. And then make something complicated out of simple pieces. Like the thing you're trying to launch is amazing and complicated and wonderful, but ideally you're building it out of simple pieces. And that's a bit what Built Value is about. Just an example, but I would also include Freeze, in the category. It gives you a way to make uniform pieces of data model that you can, that you know how they work, and they'll always work the same. And then out of those simple pieces, you can build something cool. And I would reference immutability. The reason for immutability is because it's simpler. So that's a useful hint. And also, prefer composition over inheritance is one of my favorite sentences in software engineering. It's just so, so true that if you tackle your problem and you had never learned about inheritance, the chances are you come up with a good solution. I mean, 1 out of 20, 1 out of 50 times inheritance is what, but usually it's just not. So my kind of one piece of starter coding advice is just figure out how to stay away from the complex things. The simple things are great. Let's see. I want to kind of go one step bigger and talk about bigger software engineering advice. And for me, that's end-to-end testing. End-to-end testing is amazing. If you have enough end-to-end testing, if it's fast, if it's pleasant to use, then it's just so much more pleasant to write code. And at the same time, it's faster and you get better results. So learning about end-to-end testing, investing in it, and also having really high expectations that your end-to-end tests should really be in a state where they are doing what you want, they're testing what you want, and as a result, you're just relaxed. You know that when your change goes in, you didn't break anything, and your new thing also works. And that's just such a happy place to be as a software engineer. And then finally, taking one step even further back, it's possible in this job in software to be too interested in the code. Software engineering is not just about code. One thing that I like to say is that if you took a code base, let's say you took all of Google's code and you just kind of transfer that out, it's not even remotely the same as if you have the engineers who are working on it as part of that package. A code base that doesn't have people who know it, who are working on it, is kind of a dead thing. You can't do anything with it. So software engineering is about a living code base, which means all of the communication, the documentation, the processes, the bug reports, the talking to users, everything around it that actually drives the improvement and understanding and that the next improvement, is just so, so important. So that's my third and final thing of advice is to really think about or learn about the picture outside the code that is still very much part of the problem space.
That's excellent advice. I couldn't agree more. And then finally, is there anything else you'd like to add or promote?
Yeah, well, I think I've probably given the idea that I'm super excited about BuildRunner and where it's going. So my promo note is that if you are interested in the future of BuildRunner, there is a possibility that I'm really interested to hear from you, because just generally knowing what the users want is a pretty major part of getting things right. Like, what am I going to work on next? And if you can file an issue describing something that from your point of view is wrong, there's a really good chance that you're correct. And there is a very high chance that I'll care about it. And there's also a pretty good chance, I hope, that I can do something about it. I've been on the GitHub repo, the build GitHub repo. I opened the discussions section, and that's a really good place to start any discussion about things that you would like to see. And I would love to hear from folks on that.
David, this has been a fascinating podcast. Thank you very much for your time and for sharing your experience.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Much appreciated.